there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Rod Rosenblatt. If my memory recalls me, we have spent close to, I think it's 13 weeks now doing the history of the Reformation. We've been going maybe 3 to 5 years at a time. Where you can say something, Adam?
Well, I was just thinking, 13 weeks, did you say?
Yeah.
And we've made maybe 30 years of progress. That's outstanding.
We made it to 15.
We're clipping right along.
We made it to 1545.
I feel like we're going too fast, too quickly.
Good for you.
But I promised a couple weeks ago that we would take a small break to answer questions, because we still are getting our regular email questions via Facebook message or Twitter. And I did do, we've gotten some technical questions that I've been answering by email because they wouldn't be easy to do over the shows. We had some technical questions about Greek grammar after we did the Zwingli episode. And so
we're all thankful that you just answered that one.
Yes, you're welcome. And actually, I had a lot of fun doing that, but that's not something I would want to do on a live podcast, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I did put some feelers out on Twitter the other day, and
that's social media, right?
That is social media. Okay. And it was sort of an experiment, because 90% of what I use social media for is just posting the episode every week on. And so I did a question, and we actually got seven questions sent to us. Generally, we can only get through 3 or 4 questions in a Q&A episode because of the time, so we won't get to all of them. But I've picked the ones I think we can do from both a mix of emails and that Twitter question. And so that's what we're going to do today. Before we jump in, though, I'd like to encourage everybody to go to 1517.org/podcasts. That's the landing page for the 1517 Podcast Network. There you can see all of the shows that 1517 produces every week. We're going to be at 13 shows here pretty soon, regularly every week. We do have some shows that are seasonal and the like, and you can go find all of those at 1517.com/podcast. And also, if you've been impacted by the podcast, you listen to the Thinking Fellows for a long time or a short time, and you find it helpful, please do keep in mind that we are a nonprofit. We do not generate revenue off of this show. And so the way that you can help us continue to do this show is to donate. And what's really helpful is if you can do it is a monthly recurring donation. So if you could go to the 1517.org or even the podcast site, there's a donate button up in the right-hand corner. If you press that, it has a form there. You can fill it out and you can set it up for a small monthly amount that basically says, hey, I'm committed to seeing these podcasts last. And we do really appreciate that. Okay, so we're going to jump into our questions here. The first question I'm going to throw out here is actually somewhat related to a topic that we hit in the History of the Reformation series. We had somebody say, hey, thank you for doing Zwingli on the show, but most of what you presented about his doctrinal positions was all negative. Is there anything positive doctrinally to take away from Zwingli? Because I do think we were... at least my impression was, having listened to it twice, that we were positive about him, especially in his character, but in his life on the line for what he believed, and really standing with it his whole life. But we did say that there's a lot of negative outcome, which I believe is honest, from his doctrine.
Dr. Horton tells me that Calvin himself would sometimes say, what did he do this week? A reference to Zwingli.
I'm not sure that's positive.
No, it wasn't. The other thing is a bibliographic answer, which I want to do. Christian History magazine devoted a whole issue to Zwingli, and it's not negative.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it's a historical description and doctrinal one, and I would certainly say a positive. It's worth getting a hold of that issue. Christian History Magazine, the issue on Zwingli.
Okay, Christian History Magazine, issue on Zwingli. And I do believe most of their library is available. I think some of it's blockaded off by donation or a subscription?
I belong to the electronic edition of CT, and maybe that opens the door for me.
I'll double check on it. If it is...
They're purchasable.
Okay, so I'll put the link in there. Maybe some of their collection is free, so maybe it is. Some of their collection is accessed by paywall. Either way, you can decide for yourself whether you want to go for that. But I'll include it in the show notes. I do have one positive thing I think I could throw in, though. Zwingli on Adiaphora, he has some warnings there that seem to be true in some circumstances in the modern church. Mm. He's concerned that certain church traditions being reinstated back into the reformational church will very quickly become law and laws to people of must-dos. And I think there's some of that that's true. He writes against the practice of Lent, for instance. And the reason why was, I think he even says that it's not that the idea of being penitent is wrong, but it's the idea of enforcing a particular type of penitence in the particular way you want will become a restriction on the preaching, and Christian freedom is going to be limited, and the gospel is going to be limited very quickly. And he doesn't think all people will do this wrong. He just thinks it is going to become a thing. And I agree with that in some ways, having seen the reaction of some pastors who I've heard as recently as this week, a seminarian friend of mine who submitted a sermon he was writing for a midweek preaching that he's doing at his fieldwork church, where the pastor said, "You didn't force people to be penitent." Oh. And so there's some truth to Zwingli's warning.
How does one force another to be penitent?
Of course.
Like twist their arm?
Yeah. Good luck on doing that to me.
Okay.
Or,
I felt like a throwdown.
Or this wasn't penitent enough for the season. There was too much gospel here.
Oh,
you know,
I
think that's that makes me say, hey, okay, Zwingli's warning was maybe right in some circumstances. In fact, it definitely was.
So we're supposed to be saying positives. I agree. You know, I think what you told me the last night when we were at dinner, the line is, it'll become a law to you or something like that.
Yeah, that's what he says.
And I agree with that. The issue is with somebody like Zwingli who says that, okay, you can never celebrate these traditional church seasons because it'll become a law to them or it'll become a law to you. Well, that's a law.
Yes.
You know, you know, it's better to give the warning. It's better to say, incorporate what is good, right, and salutary from the traditions of the past to the church today, but be careful of these things becoming a law to you. Be careful of, I'd say even in our circles, and every time I say this, I have to give a series of caveats here. And I am myself liturgical. I prefer liturgical services immensely over other forms. But especially I'd say these days, sometimes the impression can be given that we're worshiping the liturgy rather than the thing to which the liturgy is pointing, or the person to whom the liturgy is pointing. And I think that's a fair warning to give. It doesn't say you can't do the liturgy because it'll become a law to you. It says, of course, this is good, right, and salutary, but at the same time, be careful that this does not become a law to you and that it does not become the focus of what you're doing, but rather helps you focus on the one who has gathered you here to give his gifts.
Yeah, and I would even say the converse of that, too, is sometimes, like you said, with liturgy, sometimes if you just put a total blind trust in it, there's a lot of theologically liberal or theologically unorthodox churches that practice high worship, high liturgy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like, it's only orthodox conservative churches, biblical churches that do high liturgy. That's just not the case. And so even that can't be the total litmus test for something. So it's whether, even if it's not a law, if it becomes sort of that thing you blindly trust as giving you the right thing, that could be an issue.
I'm thankful for it as a layman because it guards me from the pastor. The church year keeps me safer from the pastor.
Yeah, the calendar.
The calendar. There are all sorts of things that keep him. For instance, if I know in a parish he's going to open with an invocation to the triune God and go right through it and end with a benediction, then I'm safer.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, to know just that.
Yeah, spend time in the Church of England.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
And you'll see this.
Yeah.
You go to a beautiful
Yep.
High mass, if you will.
Yep. High liturgy, almost zero belief.
Yep.
And the sermon, you're wondering, does this person even believe God exists?
That's right.
But the liturgy is beautiful, and there's gospel in the liturgy. But
I told one of my grad students who went to Scotland, I said, there are no Lutheran parishes there. Go to an Episcopal parish and take your phone with you, and then quietly put your earbuds in and listen to Nagel.
Or You Are Forgiven Radio.
Because the guy in the pulpit is going to be an atheist.
Yeah. Should be easier than ever with AirPods.
Should be easier than ever with You Are Forgiven.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So unless somebody has anything else, in summary, I'd say there are some positive things from Zwingli. He just deals in a lot of absolutes, which seems to then make it hard for Lutherans to go all the way with him.
Well, we're going to have a hard time giving him much credit at all because we have the memory, you know, of the quote unquote debate or meeting where
Marburg,
where he and Luther are.
Yep.
And Luther gets so frustrated with his intransigence on this that he just sort of stops on the presence of Christ's body and blood and the supper. He just kind of stops. Now, when that's such a meaningful part of our theology,
yes.
Yep.
It's difficult for us to say, well, let's look for the good in this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways, the rest of the Protestantism followed.
Oh, American Protestantism? Absolutely.
Followed Zwingli on that. And that ends up, if you're a Lutheran doing a fairly popular podcast that's listened to by more than Lutherans, you end up answering that question more than any other question.
Sure.
Yes.
Because of.
We answer the
Zwinglian theology.
We answer the baptism and communion questions
more
than any other question.
Mm, sure.
That's for sure. Mm. And I would say, like, I think that question probably came from a non-Lutheran on positive things about Zwingli. And I do hope that you thought that our treatment was at least positive, because I would bet there were some Lutherans who thought we were being too friendly to him. So
we say he wasn't Roman.
Yeah.
Well, and he lived 500 years ago. So
Adam liked that he was a soldier.
Yeah. Well, cool. I guess we'll, unless you had something, Adam, we'll go on to the next question. Okay, so the next one comes out of the tales of the episode, I believe it came out either late December or early January, that we did on theories of atonement, that was actually me, Scott, and Kelsey, which is why Adam and Rod are looking like we did. and we just basically went through the various ways it has been presented throughout church history. But what we didn't do was the argument or the debate on limited versus universal atonement. And so the question is, can we give a short summary of the difference between limited Calvinistic limited atonement and the Lutheran position of universal atonement?
if I were to summarize it, we would say yay to the penal substitution view of things being the most common in the New Testament text. We believe that Christ died for all and that hell will be populated.
Bam.
Okay, and that's really great, but in a maybe taking up 5 minutes of a segment kind of way. I like the short answer, but have 45 minutes to fill.
From the other side, I mean, if you believe that God, before the foundation of the world, decided that this person would be saved and that this person would not be saved. If you work that idea out, it's difficult to then say that Christ too died for that person that God, before the foundation of the world, decreed would not be saved. Mm-hmm. And so that's how you get this idea of limited atonement. So,
and it's trying to answer the question that the scriptures clearly say that not every human creature that has ever lived is going to be saved.
It does.
And so that's why this question
comes up. And that's important to say when universalism is coming back again like a storm.
Mm-hmm. And so this is two different ways of attempting to answer that question.
Yeah.
And I think the usual accusation against Lutherans is saying, you say that Christ's death is universally atoning for all sin of all people who've ever lived. You believe that not all people are going to be saved, which means that his atonement isn't actually efficacious.
That's usual, and it's from thinking Reformed people.
Yes.
And their favorite source beyond the biblical text is Owen's The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. I've done an extensive outline of that book. John Owen, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ.
Can I throw out a theory that you guys correct me on, or say maybe that makes a little sense as I've been talking with people with it? I think there is an interesting connection that doesn't always get fleshed out on the difference between the way we view the means of grace, baptism and the Lord's Supper and the Reformed, and how we've talked about the distribution of the gifts of Christ from the cross through the proclaimed word, through confession and absolution, through baptism, through the Lord's Supper, where we say that faith is delivered by those means. So that atonement is universal, but that direct saving faith is distributed through these means.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the answer. I mean, when I was teaching the basic theology class at the university, that's exactly, you know, that's classically how this is presented, is that you can even say to a group of students, listen, if God decided to work through, you know, in you directly, there's no way you could reject that, right? You couldn't. If he sort of just one day like shot a lightning bolt into your heart and that was your trust in Christ, there's no way that could ever be rejected or denied or anything. But God, for whatever reason, throughout the entire scriptures, and I've been sort of binge listening to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, and Chad Bird does a very good job of pointing this out. Throughout the entire scriptures, we see that God works through people and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From the beginning.
From the beginning, end. Right? I mean, down to digging his hands in the dirt to form Adam. Mm-hmm. You know, he works through people and stuff. We tend to want to see God as a white-collar God, and God's a blue-collar God. He's not the one going like this and there's a 57 Chevy. He's the one with grease on his hands and a wrench on his hand building the 57 Chevy from the ground up. That's our God for whatever reason. And he never really expressly reveals to the authors of the scriptures why. He just, this is how he works. Mm-hmm. And it's how he's worked from Genesis all the way to Revelation, getting his hands dirty. Now, the way he gets his hands dirty is what we call the means of grace. Mm-hmm. This idea that God uses people and stuff to communicate and to share and to work miracles in sinners. Now, while he can never directly be rejected, which is, I think, usually the answer back to us on this, well, do you actually think you could reject God? No. But you can't reject the stuff that he uses. Right? Or the people that he uses.
he picked things that look kind of dumb.
Yeah.
The mm-hmm. preaching of the gospel.
Yeah.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
And that idiot preacher who I grew up with and right. I know what he's really like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A common meal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of that.
Common water.
Tap water.
Yeah. All these things can be rejected. And in fact, one of the brilliance of Luther's Small Catechism, specifically when it comes to the supper and baptism, even I'd say to a degree when it comes to the preaching of the word, he actually asks and answers these questions. And this is early to get back to our Reformation history, this is early. This is before many of the other objections from non-Roman Protestants sort of come up. How does plain water do this? You know, well, it's not water. It's water in connection with the word of God. But that can be rejected because it is coming through water and through words. So that's usually what you were saying, a theory. It's not a theory. It's sort of the answer to this question.
Well, and the reason I called it a theory is because when you see the debates happen, at least in my experience, the debate's always sort of been between verses on election and verses directly about the atonement instead of moving on towards the distribution of faith.
No, I think it's a means of grace question.
Yeah, I think it is too.
I think it's a means of grace. Does God use stuff to give you the benefits of Christ?
Mm-hmm.
And can you reject, I'd say people and stuff, can you reject the words of those people and that stuff?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can. And that's how you get the benefits. Christ dies for sins of the whole world, but that applies to you in a really particular way. And the question is, how does it apply to me in a really particular way?
Yep.
particularly through the proclamation of the word and the work of the Holy Spirit through the sacrament.
And there's so, and the amount of verses on, you know, baptism and the preaching of the word and being, you know, buried with Christ and raised is much more extensive than one or two verses here on election, for instance.
Sure.
You know, it's the entirety of Romans 6.
Sure.
Is all who are baptized are going to raise with Christ.
You can't, this is probably a bad way to say it, but I've always kind of thought of it like a some sort of contest, right, where everybody, say, in a room is in on this contest to win, say, $10,000. And at the end of the night, somebody says, okay, if you win, we'll send a messenger around to your house to tell you about it, right? And the trick is that everybody in the room is going to win. And so the person who's hosting the contest sends out the messenger, and the messenger just happens to look like a homeless person on the street and comes and knocks on the door and says, you won. Well, some of those people are going to remember, you know, that maybe that person was at the party too, and they'll actually call in the receipt and say, yeah, I won my where's my $10,000? And some people are going to look at the messenger who's this homeless person and say, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Who are you? Like, they said they'd contact me. They didn't say they'd send the bum who lives on the corner to come contact me. The issue with the way God gives us the benefits of Christ is he's always sending the bum on the corner, and that's you
yeah.
and me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that bum on the corner sometimes comes bearing the gifts promised by Christ with the Holy Spirit, the bread and the wine that's the body and blood, and sometimes he comes bearing simple water. Mm-hmm. But he's still that bum on the corner that's very easy to look at and go, your message is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I think that's a good answer for not doing a whole episode on it. I think that's great. Okay, so the next one is one I think that came out of a listener who's gone back and listened to our whole apologetic series. And one of the questions is how as apologists do you deal with biblical issues on creation versus scientific accounts? And I think what would be obvious if you went through our list of apologetic episodes is you would notice that we didn't do an episode on creation in apologetics. And I think there's a lot of good reasons to this, but I'm going to throw it out to you guys.
Well, I just sent around a couple of things to several people just this last week that had to do with, one was a professor at MIT, and she was describing how she thought all Christians were idiots and how she started to take a look at it and started to think, maybe they're not. And then the other one was the winner of the Templeton Prize last year, physicist, and he tells the story of how he came to believe that Jesus was actually the author of creation. Now, he didn't say it that way, but how they were connected. Normally, the order is that if a person is drawn by the gospel to Christ, they look at the Old Testament differently afterwards because he honored every word of it. And that they didn't have that viewpoint at all. I take the creation account seriously because of the way Christ quoted the Old Testament text over and over and over and over again. Now, unless somebody else is raised from the dead after the third day, I'm going to listen to his opinion on the Old Testament text. And even quotes from the books that give us the most trouble. Genesis, Jonah, you know, the ones that are always under criticism, those are the ones he quotes from.
I was just asked this question in Michigan. Jeez, where was I? Michigan?
You were in Michigan, I think.
Somewhere.
Yeah. I did an all-day sort of four-session apologetics, and very, very bright young man came up afterwards and asked me why I didn't go over any of the creation versus evolution or type stuff. And I actually said as I began that I was not, that I planned not to cover any of that. And he was kind of bothered that I didn't, because that's sort of seemed like why he showed up that day. There's two reasons why I don't. It's just not my field of expertise. There's a lot to know there.
Most pastors didn't either. They fled those courses.
Yeah, and there's a lot to know. Even if you know sort of the basic apologetic argument and can teach the basic apologetic argument, keeping up on the most current data of all of that, it's almost a full-time job.
Yep.
And we have people in our in our circle who can do that and who do that and love to do that. So I usually defer to them on sure. that kind of thing.
Sure.
And the reason I can do that and still go out and teach apologetics is because the thrust of the I'm just going to reiterate what Rod said here. The thrust of the apologetic argument is really, did Christ raise from the dead and is he thus God or not? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Get to that. And then I can point you in the direction of the people who would be thrilled to have the conversation with you regarding some of those other things. But the way I've always, this is probably stealing from Rod, the way I've always described it is to say, listen, I have 4 hours with you today. If I spend those 4 hours convincing you that God created the world, and on the way home, you step off the curb and get hit by a bus and die, you still have not trusted in Christ as your only hope for salvation. You've trusted in a God, a nameless God, who was powerful enough to create all things, which is not a saving God.
Yep.
The only saving God is Christ.
Yep.
So when I only have an hour with you or 4 hours with you or a day and a half with you, I want to do that. And even if you're a Christian and I'm teaching you how to do that with other people, I want to teach you to do that because you probably won't have an hour or 4 hours or a day and a half. You'll probably have 10 minutes.
Yep.
And I want to teach you how to get to the gist of the gospel and its defense.
Yep.
As quickly as possible.
Yep. Again, show notes, Buy Sensible Christianity audio series from Dr. Montgomery. Buy one for yourself or buy one also for the parish so that people can check out the CDs and play them. You're going to want to own it.
Adam, do you have anything?
Well, I was just thinking, Scott's comment reminded me of C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, where he said, after he's shown there's good reason to believe God exists, he says, even at this point, mm-hmm. Christianity has not begun to spoke.
Yep.
Right. To speak.
Sorry. Yep. Yep.
So... when I do stuff on apologetics, I focus, like you, Scott, focus on the historical argument for the resurrection of Jesus, validating his divinity and so on. And I do get questions about creation, and it's exactly the same response, well, not exactly, but the same response you give. Especially when it comes to creation, science and religion, big, it's always changing. Mm-hmm. And you can spend the rest of your life.
That's my point.
Good on those people who do that. But also, to add something a little new to it, those who focus on, and I'm not going to name names, who focus on the argument that if you get creation right, everything else will follow.
No.
That is just, that's backwards. That's,
You can go into hell as a creationist.
Well, you can you can be a creationist who's an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
You know? Or think of Anthony Flew, the great atheist of the second half of the 20th century, who came to believe on the basis of design type of arguments from the information in a cell, God exists, or there's a designer that exists, but not so what?
Yeah, that's right. He never came to Christianity, but he came to roughly deism through the intelligent design argument before he died.
Well, and that's when I was saying that it's not my field, I remember, you know, I can defend sort of categorically and from sound logic, the idea that it's at least an option, right? And that it's probably as viable, not even probably, as viable, if not more viable, of an option to believe in creation than some random sort of evolution that goes from dust in the cosmos to you and me. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to keep up with and there are people who do that.
Sure.
That's not me.
That would be where I bounce too is I've had some of these conversations. I've spent some online and in person what I've noticed is that even the atheist who's pushing this as sort of their prime issue, when the argument begins,
it's philosophical.
It's philosophical, and it seems to be an issue of faith on both sides. And so it sort of gets into an argument of my faith versus your faith. And as somebody who tries to practice real empiricism, it's hard to do that in an event nobody has physically observed. And so you're debating philosophies that are changing on both sides. The evolutionary debate and the technicalities of how all that works, like you said, is constantly changing. So information I have to try to counter that.
Well, to get back to Dr. Rosenblatt's point, though, actually, somebody was there to observe it.
Yeah.
He became incarnate some 2,000 years ago.
Yep.
And then he walked around teaching publicly for 3 years, backing up what he observed as he was creating the whole thing.
Yep.
Yep.
And so, there is a bit of a distinction there. And it is kind of funny because I think one of the, just from a sort of logic point of view, one of the things you can say to evolutionists, I guess it'll be a broad term for them, is that, listen, you're talking about something that's so theoretical, so abstract, and so far removed from observable reality that it is faith.
I was at the University of Washington, was an agnostic at the time. Lutheran pietism made an unbeliever out of me. And I was led back to theism by an atheist professor in vertebrate embryology, course in vertebrate embryology. He would have been horrified. But as he laid the thing out, I thought, holy smokes, I know a little bit of math.
Yeah.
You've got to be kidding me. And so I became a theist again as a result of being in a course taught by an atheist dedicated to getting anything like that out of me, and it turned the switch.
If our listeners want one thing on that, it's the privileged planet. I mean, they actually go through the formulas a bit and say, this is not
the book, and there's also a documentary.
There's a book and a video, but they literally just lay out how this is just not a possibility.
I find those books interesting and maybe helpful if you do get stuck with somebody, but like the point was, it's usually much more fruitful to go to something that we can actually look at the evidence for, and that's the death and resurrection of Christ.
Sure.
Can I just add a bibliographical reference?
Yep, go for it.
Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute.
Yes, Seattle.
He's got a new book coming out. He wrote Signature in the Cell a couple of years ago, which is a phenomenal intelligent design type of argument. But he's got one coming out, I think it's in July or August, called The Return of the God Hypothesis. And though I've not seen the manuscript, his argument is that science, philosophy, and other related disciplines are at the point where the theistic conclusion that there's something behind the spatial temporal world is inescapable.
Good for him.
It's not Christianity, but it's one step closer, can we say? I know that's I don't like that.
And to that point, too, people who are willing to immediately dismiss that without looking into it scientifically even at all are practicing a level of faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm last one on this for me, for sure. But here's the thing.
Let's keep going.
Anytime you have this conversation with somebody, they'll say something like, the evidence all points to da-da-da. And I've taken up saying, that's interesting. To what evidence do you refer? Mm-hmm. Because there's this idea out there of this bucket full of evidence against creation that people don't know what's in the bucket. They've just been told this bucket's out there.
Yes.
And so they're willing to refer to the bucket all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, look at that bucket over there. It's got a bunch of evidence in it. I'm like, have you ever pulled anything out of the bucket and looked at the evidence?
Sure.
Answer typically is no.
Well, I just know
the bucket's there. The bucket being there gives me some real comfort.
That's the narrative, the evidence. It's all settled. The evidence all points. This is what Richard Dawkins would want you to believe. The evidence all points to a creation that while we might not know how it all began, everything is going to be explained by science.
But Adam, 8 out of 10 lab coat priests believe that evidence is true.
Well, okay, but I actually think the number's not that high.
Yeah, I bet it's not either.
I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence of scientists, I'm using air quotes, who they do their job, whatever their vocation is, and they do not need that atheistic worldview narrative, whatever you want to call it, to do their job well.
I don't think it would be taking his name in vain to name Rod Soper at Concordia, when he used to come into my core theology classes and give his sort of, he's a bio professor at Concordia University in Irvine, and give his shtick, he'd start out with his history of being an unbeliever and coming to belief, and basically an unbeliever because he was told about a bucket of belief, right, that he just had to accept in Christianity. Mm-hmm. and said, no, I can't do that, became a scientist in a very empirical science, biology, right? And then was basically told, well, there's this bucket of belief out here for biology, too, that you have to believe. And he's like, wait a minute, that's exactly what the people in Christianity told me I had to do that I was unwilling to do.
Yeah.
And now show me what it is. But he also explains that before he came to Concordia, when he was in his quote-unquote secular job, that he had to keep that under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had to keep that under wraps, or otherwise the culture of science would have, you know, really
excommunicated him.
Yep. The Church of Science would have excommunicated him. And I think Adam's right. There are more people like Rod out there that are living that life.
Yeah.
Than we
They're
will
just doing
ever
their vocation
yeah.
and keeping their the.
When he would say that in his lectures too, that he knew other people in his field who just couldn't say what was on
David
the mind,
Menton. You know? He I'm not sure. I think he's retired now. He lives in and around St. Louis, Missouri. He was an award-winning, I think it's geneticist, at Washington University, the so-called Harvard of the West. And he always makes the point that his work in genetics and everything else he did simply required lab work. That's all he did was lab work, and it did not require some atheistic, Darwinian...
It didn't require philosophy.
Yeah, it was just doing...
Body and fender work.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that's a somewhat satisfying answer. So
it's kind of funny. I got one more thing.
Okay.
Well, I also have something to add.
But that's almost like reading Luther regarding sort of peeking behind the veil. What Luther argues for a lot is doing the lab work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Get in the text. Do the lab work. Say what the text says and put it out there and stop trying to use a previous philosophy and or construct a new philosophy. Do the work and say, tell me what the data shows. It's interesting that when theology goes wrong, it seems like it's for the same reason as when science goes wrong. It's not that anybody in this room would argue against a scientist being a scientist and doing their vocation, a geneticist being in the lab mm-mm. and doing the lab work. That's what we want to have.
Yep, wonderful gift of God.
Oh,
yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just that actually doesn't require, as a presupposition, some belief in a bucket of belief out there.
Yeah. And if it does, it's not science.
And if it does, ideology. It's not science. Mm-hmm. And maybe if it does, it's not doing freaking theology either. It's doing something else.
Whoa.
Nice.
I think freaking still gets us our G rating, right?
We get to keep the clean rating with that one.
There we go.
Thank you. Okay, so we have time for our last question. And this one is about the United States. And the question basically is, why has it, and it's hard, I actually think it's always hard to answer the why is it questions, but why has it taken so long for law and gospel theology to make it into the South and still struggling?
Oh, well, there's a...
Quote Stephen Paulson here.
There's a historical reason for it. When the Lutherans got here, we very carefully built, brick by bloody brick, seminaries to train people for the ministry. Meanwhile, the circuit riders of Methodism, who owned a horse, a Bible, a bedroll, and not much else, went through the whole South and took it for Methodist Christianity. Now, 100 years later, we were able to go to the South and found it already inhabited by 90% Methodists and Baptists, with churches already built. We just were 75 years too late.
I couldn't add anything to that, Caleb. I mean, historically, a group of Germans, specifically even saying the LCMS, a group of Germans left Germany because of...
Theological oppression, basically.
Theological oppression came to a particular part of the Midwest, and from a very small group, that could be the answer too, from a very small group built another pretty much German community right down to preaching and teaching in German from the time they immigrated, which is 1860s, Adam?
A little earlier
than that, until, you know, well into the First World War, so 1914, 1918 time period, when they sort of, I don't want to say were forced to stop doing everything in German, but were kind of forced by the culture around them being anti-German at the time because of the war that we were fighting against Germany. And that was the focus. It was teaching and preaching to our people.
And there was a certain, and I would say still is, emphasis on what we have surviving. And part of that survival was sort of, with the seminaries, for instance, those seminaries are to train pastors to teach and preach in our churches. They don't go and get calls to Baptist churches or to evangelical non-denom churches.
Never.
Those are in service to the Lutheran churches of the Missouri Synod.
And that's the
difference with some other seminaries where people go to seminary in order to go back to their home church in their town.
I'll give you a good example. There are Arminians and Charismatics who go purposely to Westminster Theological Seminary and they never become Reformed. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the Westminster degree.
Yeah.
When I was in Europe, they only recognized about 3 or 4 seminaries or groups in the United States. It was the 2 Concordias, the 2 Westminsters, and they included Princeton. Hmm. But that was it. That was the whole list.
Yeah.
Harvard wasn't onto it. None of the liberal seminaries. And
I had somebody send us an email who was not a Lutheran asking for seminary recommendations.
Oh, good grief.
And I said, it's hard for me to do this because unless you were to become a Lutheran, the seminaries in my tradition would not really be open to you. You wouldn't be able to receive a call or an MDiv at all without first confessing our confessions. So that's it's harder for me to answer because it's hard for me to say I have a category for a seminary where you don't intend to go teach in that church body.
Now that's not true of some of the other American Lutheran church bodies that have, specifically the two that it came out of the ELCA, the North American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church and Missions for Christ, LCMC. I think they do accept candidates from other seminaries now. Mm. But I think even there, if you come in as a candidate from a non-Lutheran seminary, you're going to do probably a year's worth of...
Or more.
Well, in the LCMS, more for sure. But I think in the NALC or LCMC, I bet it's not more.
Okay.
Then do about a year's worth of sort of your Lutheran year,
mm-hmm.
where you'll probably take systematics from one of the Lutheran systematicians. You'll probably take Lutheran confessions.
Yep.
I think it'd be good to do like a hermeneutics or sort of class.
If we had a hermeneutics book.
Hermeneutics. Yeah.
I don't know.
But
I'm not in those kinds of
books. And again, I'm not saying that's, I'm not saying it's right or wrong or anything, but that is probably part of the reason, just that we don't have pastors from our tradition going to other churches.
So. Yeah. Well, the original question had to do with why is there no law gospel preaching in the South? And I think the answer is historical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too. I don't. Yeah. But.
Yeah, it's a different. If you go back before the Civil War, the character of Christianity in the South is just very different.
Sure.
Than, say, the character of Christianity, not in the North, but amongst. Think proper confessional evangelicals.
Yeah, think of just, Duvall in The Apostle, or think of the
that's
one.
That's a movie reference.
Oh, yeah, movie reference.
Yeah,
or think of the one that's kind of a remake of Ulysses in the South.
Yes.
What was the name of that? can't recall it, but. Great music, but throughout it, you're picking up Southern American Christianity.
Is it, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes, that's it. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
That's a fun movie, too.
Sure it is.
Yeah. I really like that movie.
Pop culture reference, score one.
That was
me, but
pretty good, Adam. I'm sort of
20 years ago.
Shocked that you knew that.
Well, no. Cool. I think that makes us to time. I hope that everybody who... I know that I didn't get to every single question asked, but we will have time again later in the year. We're not doing a Q&A every 4 weeks this year because that ended up being a lot of Q&A last year. But if you do have questions, that one tweet 2 weeks ago was not the only opportunity to ask them. So you can always send us messages directly through our email on our website. You go to thinkyfellows.com, and there is a contact button, and you can fill out a form, and that gets sent directly into my inbox, and I look at all of those. You can also send them via Twitter or Facebook, and I'll get to them also. I'm usually a little faster with email than I am with Facebook, so just keep that in mind. All right. Thank you for answering. Thank you for listening and asking questions on this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.